From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we look at the different ways communities memorialize mass shootings around Milwaukee. Then we learn how the coronavirus is changing the way wastewater is being treated. Our auto contributor reminds us to remember our cars.
Probably best to take it out and just run around the neighborhood a little bit with the car, get things running and moving, because not just the battery needs to be recharged, but all of your seals, all of your gaskets, they start to dry out if there's no liquids going through them.
Plus, we look at efforts to regulate CBD products.
So essentially what you're looking at is the Wild West on the grocery shelf or the drugstore shelf or the specialty store shelf. Nothing has been through that rigorous testing, and that's really what we're concerned about.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. It might be hard to believe, but the fatal mass shooting at Milwaukee's Molson Coors Brewery happened just 3 months ago. The shooting killed six people, including the shooter. Unfortunately, this kind of tragedy wasn't new to Milwaukee. Gun violence is an issue that has continued to plague the city. But how we remember these mass shootings and memorialize them is unique to each of these incidents. Journalist Adam Rogan wrote about how we do and don't memorialize these sites in a piece featured in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. He joins me from his home. Adam, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Glad to be here.
So, some of the more infamous shootings, like the mass murder at the Sikh temple, have had a really lasting impact on our collective memory. But what are some of the mass shootings that have happened here in the Milwaukee area that we may have forgotten about?
I think now that we're looking back, it's been almost 8 years since the Sikh temple shooting. Is that shooting stood out so vividly in our minds because partially because they got national media attention. It was on CNN either that night or the next morning. Anderson Cooper was here. And so it got all that attention, and it was, I think, partially just because of its origin as a hate crime and being this minority community that Oak Creek really rallied around. But there's some other shootings that kind of went by the wayside. The deadliest mass shooting in Wisconsin history wasn't even that one. It was on March 12th, 2005 at a Sheraton Hotel, or what's now a Sheraton Hotel in Brookfield, where seven people, eight if you include the shooter, died. And that was a deadly shooting, but it was one that was... It didn't get this huge national attention. They never really figured out the motive. It was somebody who had some mental illness problems, who was a member of a church that was celebrating at that hotel. They were in one of the conference areas. And it was the deadliest mass shooting in Wisconsin history. And I didn't know about it until just a couple months ago when I started working on a story for this. And it kind of shows just how quickly we can move on. There was one that I remember, because it was only a couple months after the Oak Creek Sikh temple shooting, was at Azana Salon and Spa, which is actually not far from the Brookfield Hotel where the shooting was in 05, where three people and the shooter all died. And that one's a little more remembered because the people at that spa wanted to remember their coworkers, and so that lasted. And the Molson Coors shooting, obviously, is a unique scenario in that it was only a few months ago, but I don't remember the last time I even talked about it because I think because coronavirus happened, and so we all just kind of moved on from it, at least for the time being.
Yeah. A big part of what your piece looks at, of course, is how these sites look today, essentially, whether or not people have created memorials to what happened. So when you look at these different sites around the Milwaukee area, what are the different ways that they've chosen to remember what happened or not?
So, for example, with the Sikh temple shooting, there's a memorial inside the library at the temple with just photos to each of those who died from it. I'm just really remembering who they were, especially since a lot of them were really instrumental to that temple and that community. At least one of them, if not two, I believe two of them were priests in the temple. So obviously they want to kind of remember these kind of founding father figures for them. At the Azana Salon, there's a inside one of the three people who died. Their workstation was turned into kind of a memorial, and it's still there. if you went there for, you know, just a normal spa day or so, getting a haircut or something, you might not notice it because it's not like super present, but it's still there, I think, mainly for the owner and for the coworkers to remember the lives that were lost. But then if you go to the Sheraton Hotel, there's nothing there. It's interesting that it's the site of the deadliest shooting in the history of our state, and it's just a normal hotel. I went there, I think it was in March, and inside one of the conference rooms where the shootings happened, there was a conference going on, just like it was a normal day. And it made this really interesting moment of something really significant happened here. Quite a few lives were lost, but moved on. With Molson Coors, within a week or two, the facility was back up and running. When I was working on the story, the Molson didn't really know what they were going to do at the plant long term, because obviously it was still pretty fresh. And there were, of course, in the whole neighborhood, there were, you know, balloons and flower memorials and stuff like that. But in terms of permanent remembrances for it, there wasn't really anything yet, at least.
Yeah. Well, and it's still relatively new. It only happened in late February. When you've talked to people at these different sites, what has been the rationale for either memorializing these spaces or not memorializing them, keeping what happened there kind of under wraps?
I'm not sure if under wraps is the right word for it, but it's this interesting kind of this dichotomy of, do you want to be able to move on, which of course we all want to do, or do you want to... it's a question about what is the right way to move on, I think is a better way to put it on my part. But when you talk about trying to move on, it's a question of, do you need to have this permanent remembrance of lives that were lost, or is it better to remember what happened to yourself and go and move on? It's tough to know. One of the people I talked to for this story was Erica Doss. She's a professor from the University of Notre Dame. She, by chance, grew up in Wisconsin. And she wrote this really interesting book called Memorial Mania, Public Feeling in America. And it's about kind of a critical look at how Americans tend to remember tragedy. Looking at everything from, you know, a roadside memorial with a cross and flowers and something like that for somebody died in a car accident or a shooting, for example, or these really big parks or massive monuments like the ones that you can see at Columbine or at the site of the Oklahoma City bombing. And her argument was that is that these monuments don't necessarily achieve anything. She made a point, it's important to remember these tragedies, whatever they are, but that putting a lot of money and effort and consternation into a building or a park doesn't necessarily bring a public good. She argued that we should be having more policy changes or have memorials actually mean something. One thing that an idea she really was a proponent of was scholarships for affected families, which is something that happened in Molson Coors. And that's kind of what might not be their memorial. They raised, I believe, $2 million for the families of the deceased to basically help them through this pretty horrible time. That's something that she was supportive of, is what you could call an expert in that world.
So has anything changed in the time since these mass shootings? You know, you talked about policy. Has anything changed to make these events less likely to happen in Wisconsin?
In Wisconsin, to my knowledge, the rules obviously surrounding guns are tough to change, but there are certainly, I think the one thing that, you know, well, I think it's fair to say a very divided political climate. Both sides very much agree that more money is going to mental health, and more money has been going into mental health over the past couple of decades in Wisconsin and nationwide. And mental health has clearly played a role in all four shootings I looked at, one being a hate crime, one being someone with documented mental illness problems, and somebody who's a disgruntled ex who obviously went too far, and these showing signs of very clear mental illness problems. And that's something that a lot of the focus has been on, and there's been more money and more attention put there. When it comes to guns, obviously, I think it's fair to say not a ton has changed. That's something that Erica Doss called for. Of course, plenty of others say that the issue isn't guns. It's people with mental illness problems that lead to these attacks, and that needs more addressed. But really, the literal change that at least Erica Doss, Professor Doss, was looking for hasn't really happened yet, certainly since she wrote the book or in the few months since Molson Coors.
When you say there's more money going toward mental health, have we seen more mental health facilities? Have we seen more care in schools? Have we seen more care in the workplace? What has that actually looked like?
From what I've learned and gathered and of course studied in my work, I found that in the last couple decades, especially since I was in school, that a lot more schools are putting more money into actually having staff psychologists. Of course, there's massive shortages of that everywhere, especially in Wisconsin. And in Milwaukee, we need more people to be willing to do that. And to go into it's a field that needs more professionals, perhaps because we haven't put the emphasis on it that it may be needed. In terms of facilities, there hasn't been a lot of growth. I think it's been something that I know that Governor Evers and in Republican leadership actually agree on. So maybe when we get out of this coronavirus thing, it'll be something that we might see focus on again. But it's something that perhaps I misspoke earlier, that we haven't seen massive change yet, but it's been something that's at least being talked about and something that we could start seeing with more people being willing to open up about mental illness rather than keeping it down. And that can lead to more people seeking help rather than perhaps going down a dark path. It can lead to some pretty bad places.
So it seems like there's been a lot of lip service, at least on the part of politicians, but maybe not a lot of action.
We haven't seen a massive world of change, at least in the past few years. I think that the thing that will start creating that change will be not only pressure by politicians, but also, you know, on a local level in terms of just having more people go into these fields. And I'm not sure how many 15-year-olds or 16-year-olds think about college are thinking, yeah, I want to be a school psychologist. It's not something that's talked about a ton. And perhaps it should be as a really important career field that has benefited a lot of people, and myself included, in that having people who are able to help and willing to help and realizing the importance of professional support systems and how they can really benefit you in your day-to-day life is something that that at least in Wisconsin is not part of our normal day-to-day life, and something that I think could really benefit if we had more help. And I know that's a very broad and vague answer, but more help, especially from people who are trained psychologists and have doctorates in these things that I certainly don't, would be beneficial to all of us, regardless of how extreme our issues might be.
Yeah. All right. Well, Adam Rogan, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
So glad to do it. Thank you so much for having me, Joy.
Adam Rogan is a local journalist whose work was featured in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. Coming up, the heavy rains forced an overflow dump into Lake Michigan this week. We'll learn why that raises concerns about the spread of COVID-19. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Sunday's record rainfall overwhelmed the sewage system here in Milwaukee. The lingering rain filled up the deep tunnel, forcing the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District to do an overflow dump. That means they released sewage water into Milwaukee's waterways, which flow into Lake Michigan. MMSD says the goal is to avoid basement flooding and home damage. But this overflow dump has raised concerns about the spread of the coronavirus. The CDC says the virus has been found in untreated wastewater. And researchers are still trying to figure out if someone can get sick by coming in contact with the water. WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz spoke to Kevin Schaefer, the executive director of MMSD, about what we know about the danger of COVID-19 in sewage water. He begins by explaining the deep tunnel's capacity and how it deals with heavy rains.
The deep tunnel is just a large bathtub underground. It can hold 432 million gallons of water for the original tunnel. And then we have what's called the Northwest Side Tunnel, which adds another 89 million. So we have a total of 521 million gallons of storage that we can hold. And we also service an area of 411 square miles. And if you spread an inch of water over that 411 square miles, it works out to 7 billion gallons of water. So if you take 5 inches of rain, 7 billion times 5, that's 35 billion gallons. It's trying to find some place to go. So sure. It's either going into the tunnel or the rivers or, you know, wherever.
Mm-hmm. With this massive storm, there were a number of sewer backups as well. I've heard that in Bayside, that was the case.
Yeah.
not a happy time. So part of the reason I called you, Kevin, is that we've heard from some listeners, because obviously there's a heightened concern about COVID-19. One of these concerns is it's making its way into wastewater. So when there's an overflow, when an overflow has to happen in the system, that raises concern for some about rivers in Lake Michigan. And one listener wrote, is if nothing is done, the virus will be waterborne. What is known and unknown about the potential danger of the virus in wastewater?
Well, that's a better question for Sandra McClellan. You know, that's more of a scientific question. But I can tell you that, you know, when we treat wastewater through the wastewater treatment plant system, it kills the virus. That's what the disinfection portion of our plants is supposed to do. Now, when we have these large storms, what you're really trying to do is to minimize the exposure of any virus, whether it's COVID-19 or any virus, to people in their homes. And so you're trying to avert those basement backups that might occur. So we have overflows to protect public health and safety to try to avert those viruses that would be in people's basements. Mm-hmm. And I know we did have basement backups this week. We're investigating all of those to see, you know, if it was a local system that's had the problem or our system. But you have to remember that each community has its own sanitary system, and that sanitary system drains to our system. And so sometimes there's backups upstream of our system, and we have no control over that.
So you mentioned Sandra McClellan, and I know that MMSD is collaborating, or she is collaborating with you in a project that might result in ongoing monitoring for the coronavirus in wastewater. Could that potentially lead to any modification in how MMSD then treats its treatment process?
Well, in the long term, once we get some good information and some good science, it could. We could look at a different means of disinfection if that proves to be more of an effective killer of these viruses. But right now, I've not seen any of that. And I did hear Sandra say that they don't know that. So there are these viruses in wastewater, but from what she knows, she's not sure that they're still infectious at that stage. Mm-hmm. You know, I would rely on her for that scientific information. But we have overflows to protect public health, to keep it out of people's basements. The COVID-19, based on what the science is telling us today, and it could change later, says that the virus, while it may be in wastewater, they don't think it's infectious. And then, you know, will this or could this change the way we treat wastewater throughout the world in the future? It could. But, you know, we just like everything else with this, we have to let the science dictate the discussion and mm-hmm. and then follow through with an implementation plan for whatever needs to be done. But we've been partnered with Sandra. Boy, the first day, you know, way back middle of March, she called and asked if she could start taking samples and freezing them for this testing that she's doing. And we've been doing that. So all you can do is try to provide the best data for the scientists to look at.
One of the organizations that you're actively involved in is the Water Research Foundation. It recently held a summit to look at research, what's known, unknown about COVID, how scientists and researchers can collaborate with public health. Can you tell us anything about the, more about the group, obviously, but also these efforts to promote and fund new COVID-19 research?
Well, the Water Research Foundation is a class organization. I'm a past president, past chair of the board for that organization. And it is the universities of the country and of the world, and it is targeted research through the Water Research Foundation that will help us address these issues. So the Water Research Foundation, they're based in two offices, one in Denver, one in Alexandria, Virginia. They have staff devoted to looking at all types of pollutants and concerns with drinking water and wastewater. And so I was not part of that discussion that they had the other day. I saw it advertised but couldn't make it. But that is one of the forums where you'll find the answers to some of the questions that we're all waiting to hear.
Do you think then and hope that there might be the science coming through in these efforts through the Water Research Foundation and solutions, ways we can look at avoiding what's happened around the world right now?
I do. And, you know, I think some of it, I mean, it will never be an exact science, but I do think that the work that's being done now will help give us indicators of what might happen or what did happen. And we'll learn from the history as we move forward. So we might be able to better predict earlier in a cycle an uptick of COVID-19 or some other virus through this work that they're doing now. We may also come up with better ways to disinfect and kill these viruses, as I talked about earlier, which might lead to more changes in our systems that we treat wastewater with. So it's really those organizations that are the really smart people. You know, they're the ones that are day-to-day, elbow deep in the research on this, trying to solve these issues for the entire world. And again, we look to them for answers, and then they look to us for implementation.
So I've seen you call yourself a wastewater nerd, and there's a lot. Fortunately, there's a lot of water nerds around who are helping us. Do you think this is a period of time when more of us will begin to grapple, you know, get more of a grip on the importance of water as such a fragile resource?
I hope so. You know, there's so many stressors on our water environment, whether it's overpopulation, drought, floods, heavy rains like we just went through here, PFAS, the forever chemical that we're finding now, COVID-19. I mean, there's always going to be a stressor. And people need to understand that they're part of that cycle. And if they can do something to improve the downstream water environment just a little bit, it all adds up and helps everyone. So, you know, I know a few people that didn't shower yesterday because of the heavy rain, and that might have helped someone downstream not have a basement backup in their system. Just looking at ways to manage stormwater better on your lot, whether you have a rain barrel or a rain garden or some other green infrastructure, that not only helps manage stormwater, but also helps us address this changing climate, which may be probably the biggest stressor out there on the water resources of our world. So there's a lot to do. There's a lot of things to be concerned about. COVID-19 is definitely something we're all concerned about right now. But when we have an overflow, we do it to prevent and reduce the risk of public health issues with our public. I don't want to have them. You know, I was up almost all day and night Sunday working on it. So it's one of those things you just got to work through.
So MMSD put a lot of time and energy in putting together a 2019 resilience plan. Elements or strategies that you all worked on that you feel would be useful now, especially now?
Sure. Well, the resilience plan that we wrote was really a community plan. It's not just focused on MMSD and the work that we do. It's focused on what we can be, how we can be more resilient as a region. But the issues that we're facing today with COVID-19, with the overflows that occurred this week, is really trying to manage stormwater and water better. So green infrastructure, I know, is one of the major recommendations in that plan. And that is something that, again, everyone can do. It's low cost. It helps people downstream. It adds habitat to the region. It greens up the region. It reduces our heat island impacts. There's so many benefits of green infrastructure that we don't talk about. We just talk about stormwater. And, you know, we need to have those discussions and we need to implement. And I think the resilience plan is a great framework to forward that discussion on.
So you've touched on a number of things, Kevin, but do you have any final thoughts that you'd want to share with listeners about the role individuals or maybe banding together as neighborhoods and communities to tackle and stave off the issues that we're facing today and look at a sustainable water resource, if not all of our resources?
Yeah, you know, I think the biggest message is that we need to work together. It can't all be solved by the community you live or the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewage District or as an individual. If we did that individually throughout the region, we would not be successful. What we need to do is band together to try to work on these things, these issues, in a cohesive, well thought out, well researched approach that will provide a bigger bang for the investment that we're going to have to make on these future storms. Because we're seeing much wetter years hit us in the last 3 to 4 years. And we need to be able to not just say, oh, there's another storm. We need to be able to learn what we've learned and address it in the future in a better fashion. So I think it really takes individuals working with neighborhood groups, with their municipalities, with, you know, different organizations that they might be members of, their churches, and come together and say, how can we help and work together on these issues? We've had huge support from so many people. So it really has been a sea change from 20 years ago.
So, but I guess I can't help but ask one more question. You're involved at all levels of conversation, from governments, international, to the local and the neighborhood. What kind of, I mean, the clock is ticking here. I think that's fair to say, and all sorts of levels. And what will it take? Will it take action and coordination at all levels internationally, or how do you sort it out?
Wow, that's a big one. You know, I think it needs to be a coordinated effort. So I do think at the national level, there needs to be a coordinated approach to dealing with these different issues. You know, PFAS, whatever the issue is, PFAS, COVID-19, whatever. But then you need to really have that grassroots. So I think it's a bottom-up and a top-down approach. You really need to just make sure that people understand what the science is telling them and not just what they may hear somewhere, but let the science do the talking for us on these issues and then believe it, you know, and don't say, well, that doesn't really mean anything to me. But understand it, believe it, and then implement.
Kevin Schaefer is the executive director of the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District. He spoke with WUWM's Susan Benz. Coming up next, our auto contributor, Mark Savage, talks about how the coronavirus has impacted car sales and manufacturing. Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. Since the coronavirus outbreak began, sales of new cars across the country are down significantly. Auto manufacturing has been hindered by disruptions in the supply chain, and some plants have shut down. Despite low interest rates and new safety precautions at dealerships, it may not be enough to encourage people to buy a new car, especially since consumer spending is down overall. Plus, with many of us working from home, we're spending even less time in our cars. But auto contributor Mark Savage recommends still driving your car every once in a while to avoid bigger problems down the road. He joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to discuss car care and what the immediate future of the auto industry may look like.
Mark Savage, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thank you.
So as most people are working from home, we've definitely not been using our cars as much. So what are some general basic car care tips we should follow in order to make sure that leaving our cars in the garage won't lead to further problems down the road? Because it's easy to forget about them.
It is easy. And, you know, if you don't have something you're going out for every week at least, then you probably need to go start your car occasionally. You don't want your battery to dry up on you and stop having a charge. So I'd say every couple of weeks, if you're not using your car weekly, go out and just start the car. If you've let it go so far that it already is dead and you had to get a jump start, then it's usually suggested that you go about 30 minutes of runtime. And my thought would be probably best to take it out and just run around the neighborhood a little bit with the car, get things running and moving. Because not just the battery needs to be recharged, but all of your seals, all of your gaskets, they start to dry out if there's no liquids going through them. So when you start your car up, obviously the oil and the antifreeze and everything starts moving. And that kind of helps keep everything lubricated and ready to go. One other weird thing is probably more of a problem in the winter if you leave your car sit for maybe a month at a time, is you get a flat spot on the bottom of the tires. And most of the time that'll work itself out after you drive a little bit, but sometimes, maybe even an older tire, it won't round out as quickly or as much. So you might be driving and always have a little thumpity thump or a little bit of a vibration there. So you want to keep doing that basically. So it's just don't let your car sit for more than like 2 weeks at a time, I would say.
And drive it around for about 10 minutes?
Yeah, I'd say drive around for 10 minutes. You know, we're all kind of tired of being in the house, and especially on the rainy days that we've had so many of. So what's wrong with, you know, you're not infecting others if you're just driving in your car, is the way I look at it anyway. I'm no scientist, but I think, what the heck, you know, I get in my car, I can drive around the neighborhood, maybe 10 or 15 miles, turn around, come back. Where I live, I can easily be out in the country in about 5 minutes. So it's kind of nice to go see some trees starting to bloom and things like that.
And speaking of trees blooming, as we get into spring and early summer here, usually this is a prime time for car sales, but obviously car sales are down. So what kind of consumer-friendly financing or sales strategies are out there? And is it really working if we have nowhere to go? I don't think they can market their way out of it.
Well, I know that, you know, there's been a lot more ads for low interest rates for cars right now. I just talked to Jim Tolkien over at the Dealers Association the other day. He said the good news is Wisconsin's not doing as poorly as the nation on these things, on car sales. For April, I think national sales were down 49%, and here it was only like 42% or something along that line. But the problem, of course, being is that April, a lot of times when people are getting tax returns, they're going to go out and spend, you know, some of the money on that or use it as a down payment. So that's why you're now starting to see these new offers come out. And, you know, the car dealerships are open. They're an essential business, and you can get your car serviced and you can buy things. They do things a little differently right now. Like they're doing a lot of stuff over the phone. Obviously, servicing your car, you can't do that way. But buying one, you can do almost all your research online and figure out your deal and so forth. And like anything else, all of this is just being smart. Do as much research as you can at home and call the dealership or email the dealership. They're still doing test drives. I've talked to a couple of dealers. Everybody's happy to do test drives. Most of the salespeople are, you know, they have kind of limited staffs right now, but they will arrange for you to go drive. Someone from the dealership won't necessarily go with you because obviously they don't want to be sharing that enclosed space with you. And then when you get back, they wipe down the car. They have disinfectant that they'll be using on the doorknobs and the steering wheel and so forth. In fact, you know, I get the test cars all the time that I'm testing, and that's exactly what they do. When they bring it to me, as they get out of the car, they're wiping off the steering wheel and anything that they've touched, obviously, gear shifts and radio buttons and whatever. So incentives are out there. And then I've also read that we're going to be looking at probably $3,000 to $6,000 rebates on cars, which, I mean, I'm old enough to remember that when almost every car was sold with a rebate at some point because they were trying to get the car sales moving. And, you know, that's a pretty amazing chip off of any car. You know, average car is 35, 36,000, average truck 45,000. So.
And with the cost of not just buying a car, but making a car, how has car manufacturing been impacted? Would you compare it to the situation in what was troubling the car industry in 2008 during the recession? Obviously, these are different circumstances in which plants had to close for a period of time or reduce operations. But how are we going to see the car industry?
Right. Well, the car sales themselves are way worse than they were in 2008 as far as just for the last 2 months. Yeah, obviously, everybody could sell probably almost all of February. It's not the same because the problem now is every car manufacturer has a just-in-time way of doing business. And for those unfamiliar, that means a transmission is shipped from the factory next door that makes it, or the other company that makes it for you that's nearby. That comes in that one door. They put it on the assembly line. It goes down and gets installed in the vehicle, and the car rolls out the other end. And it's the same for all the product, all the components of a car. So what has happened was, as soon as any factory that supplied manufacturer starts going down, or you know, starts closing, then they got to stop making the cars. And it's also going to take probably, I'd say, 4 to 6 weeks for the car makers to kind of get back up to full capacity. Right now, they're just starting back up. Ford announced it was opening up some of its plants on Monday earlier this week. And I think you'll see them probably start at a low level to try and just get things moving again. And then one thing I also heard is that the Mexican factories that supply a lot of the components for the cars these days, most of them are still closed down because they haven't reopened anything yet. So it may be a little while before we see full production. And I think that Jim Tolkien told me that dealer inventory is about 30 to 45 days right now. That's not bad, obviously, if you want to go in and buy a car, but usually they're 60 to 90 days. So sometime this summer, I would imagine they'll get back to where they need to be, assuming factories all open and things keep rolling along.
With that just-in-time system, does it make sense to start making cars right away if a lot are just sitting on lots waiting to be sold?
Well, I think the thought is that they want to probably get the most popular things back. Pickup trucks are the most popular things in our culture these days, and some SUVs, of course. But pickup sales for the last couple of months, the domestic pickup trucks have totaled more than all the car sales in the last couple of months. So they're going to be trying to get those factories fired up as quickly as possible, because that's what people want. And that's what's sold out, or that is down to just minimal supplies that are out there. And so they got to get stuff like that back into the lineup.
So the sale of new cars are a little dependent on what's available, and of course production starting to ramp up once again. But what about when it comes to used cars?
Well, used cars is kind of a bottomless pit, and it's always there, and there's always a lot of cars out available. Obviously, some are being traded in on those new cars, but some people are just selling, or you know, they've decided they only need one car instead of two, maybe at this point. I've been talking to a couple of people who say used cars are plentiful right now. The auctions that sell used cars to all the dealerships, which we have there just south of Milwaukee, they've actually kind of cut their costs on this, and they're not selling at as high a margin. So the good news is dealers can buy more cars that way to supplement their lots. If they don't have enough new cars, they can get some more used cars to put on the lot. They didn't cost them quite as much, and that means they can either pass that savings on to you, which hopefully most of them do, but they also may be able to work out a little bit higher margin for themselves, which, you know, helps keep them in business and helps keep people employed. Another thing that I've heard is some of the car rental agencies have started selling some of their cars to the auctions and so forth. And that is probably going to supply us with even more newer used cars that will be in the marketplace.
Much like any other businesses or on the individual level, we've been getting financial aid. Do you think congressional aid is needed once again to help out the auto industry?
Well, I wouldn't doubt that it might be needed at some point. I think that's probably a little bit further down the road until we see, now that things are starting to reopen, how quickly does stuff come back, and what kind of shape are the businesses in? I know the incentive plans and the grants that have been given through the Small Business Administration has helped the car dealerships, because that was meant to pay salaries. And so they've been able to pay salaries, generally speaking, through April and probably partially into May. So now we're looking at, you know, is that extended? One dealership said that they were breaking even because of those loans that they got, or not loans, but grants that they got. So I think that's a good thing for them, but we'll see. It may be another month or two before we know any more about that.
Now, on the other end of the car spectrum, there's, of course, all the recreational activities. There's races, car shows in the summers. Do you imagine a smaller or a drastically changed season when it comes to those fronts? I mean, people aren't going to want to flood to convention centers.
No, sadly, I think, Milwaukee was lucky we got our car show in before this all happened. So that was nice. I know the, you know, other shows, New York show, now the Detroit show was supposed to be in July. So I would imagine that those will be canceled. A lot of races have been canceled. I know Slingers Speedway was supposed to have races this last weekend. Of course, it rained. That's been put off for at least another week. But I think you'll see some of that start to come back. the car shows, I'm not sure how those will be handled, but I think if they're outdoors and in a big field or something, they may be able to do that and just limit the number of people that come in. But I think what we're looking at is a summer without many of the sports and the car events and things that we really, you know, a lot of people, especially in Wisconsin, enjoy for the summer because it's something you can do, go outside and enjoy the summer weather. But I think we're going to be seeing limited racing, limited car shows and all that, probably at least to the fall and maybe beyond, you know, depending on what the virus does and does it bounce back on us or not.
Excellent. Well, Mark Savage, thanks again.
No problem at all. I'm not doing anything else. I'm just sitting here in the house.
Mark Savage is Lake Effect's auto contributor, and you can find all of our past segments with him at WUWM.com, along with his weekly column. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. After the break, we look into the efforts to regulate CBD products. That's when Lake Effect returns in just a moment on 89.7 WUWM. More of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. CBD shops have been popping up all over Milwaukee and Wisconsin. CBD products use cannabinoids that come from hemp plants and aren't supposed to contain any psychoactive properties. These products may have benefits ranging from stress and anxiety relief to reducing pain and inflammation. But out of the hundreds of CBD products available, only one has actually been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. And a recent poll by the National Consumers League found that 90% of Wisconsinites support the regulation and testing of CBD products. Sally Greenberg is the executive director of the NCL, which is working with the FDA to create recommendations to protect consumers against the potential risks of CBD products. She joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski by phone in March to explain more.
Sally Greenberg, welcome to Lake Effect. It's great to have you on the line.
I'm delighted to be here.
So before we get into the bigger questions developing with CBD products, let's go to the basics. What is CBD and what do consumers use it for on a daily basis?
Well, CBD is a byproduct of the hemp plant, and it is by definition part of the hemp plant that does not have psychoactive effects like marijuana does. CBD was part of the farm bill that okayed the growing of hemp and the sale of CBD products, according to Congress, have to include the fact that the products that are sold as CBD have no or minute amounts of psychoactive ingredients in them.
So,
does that make sense?
Absolutely. Distinguishing that difference, because a lot of people automatically assume it's made from hemp plant, there must be some added drug effects like marijuana. But with CBD...
That said, let me add,
sure,
though, that one of the problems that we're seeing is that while CBD products are not supposed to have THC in them, some of the testing indicates that they have higher levels of THC than are legal and do potentially have psychoactive properties, and it's especially concerning if you're giving this to pregnant women, if you're giving this to kids, or someone's taking a drug test as part of their job and THC turns up in their blood because of higher levels than are advertised on the CBD product.
Right. And with the rise of these products, with what testing has been done, obviously it's not yet possible to test every product on the market, but what other kinds of substances have been found in products marketed as CBD?
Yes. Well, one of the concerning issues is that there is only one CBD product that has been gone through the very rigorous FDA testing process for a pharmaceutical, and it's called Epidiolex, and it was approved by the FDA with active CBD ingredient that is a very pure form of CBD and does have some therapeutic benefits, but it's gone through this rigorous clinical trial process. Everything else on the market that it contains CBD has not been tested, whether it's in You know, you have drugs. Those are the most rigorously tested products. Then you have dietary supplements. Then you have food. Then you have cosmetics. And all of them have some, if they're legitimate and FDA gives a green light to them, they have to go through some rigorous FDA standards before they can be regarded as safe. And none of the products on the market have gone through any of those FDA rigorous standards or provided background information on whether they are both safe and effective. So essentially what you're looking at is the Wild West on the grocery shelf or the drugstore shelf or the specialty store shelf or the CBD, you know, outlet that sells all kinds of CBD-infused products. Nothing has been through that rigorous testing, and that's really what we're concerned about. And we did find in our polling that consumers, by a huge margin, 83%, said they want the FDA to come in and provide a regulatory framework for these products.
Right. You mentioned the Wild West, and with the lack of testing and regulation, are there any current laws and regulations regarding CBD? And besides our one FDA-approved drug, how are these being enforced, if there are any currently?
Well, interestingly, what the FDA said last week in its report to Congress, it said, we cannot conclude that CBD is generally recognized as safe among qualified experts for its use in human or animal food. Thus, CBD foods and beverages are illegal under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. So I think the answer to your question is no, none of these products pass FDA muster. They're considered illegal because they include food additives or drugs, dietary supplement additives that have not been approved or met the rigorous standards that the FDA sets for these products.
Do you think this would result in stores pulling these products off their shelves? Or, you know, because I imagine it would take a long time for someone to see the FDA report to Congress and then, say, go into a local market here where they have a CBD products locked up. How does that translate to what consumers are going to see and have available down the line?
So what's going on with the FDA is I think they have a lot on their hands right now.
Mm-hmm.
They are doing, I think we've met with them. They are trying to get up to speed. They are reporting to Congress. We've been to Congress to ask them to ask the FDA to get into this area and provide rules and regulations for these products. The one thing the FDA has done is in the most outlandish and unsubstantiated claims by certain companies, very irresponsibly claiming that their CBD products can address Alzheimer's or cancer or HIV. FDA has said you must cease and desist making those claims, or they have the ability to shut the company down for making claims that don't have any scientific evidence. So they've sent 70 or 80 warning letters out, and the warning letters are actually very important. Most legitimate companies do not want to be on the other side of an FDA warning letter. But that said, that falls far short of actual setting regulatory standards for the CBD products that are out there. And that's what we're asking the FDA to do. We've got some standards like generally regarded as safe. Salt is in that category. As long as you don't overdo the amount that you're taking in, there's a certain level you're supposed to have, milligrams every day. But if you're using reasonable amounts of salt or consuming it, that's generally regarded as safe. Caffeine, as long as you're taking in 400 milligrams or less, that's generally regarded as safe when it comes to caffeine. So in other words, there are products that we use every single day that meet the generally regarded as safe standard, the GRAS standard, and none of these CBD products meet that test.
And I imagine the rapid growth of CBD shops and products in other retailers hinders quite a lot of regulation in trying to gain any lead on this.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think that just this unexpected explosion of products on the market has really overwhelmed, I think, regulators and those of us who are trying to warn consumers, you know, you got to be careful with this very a new, untested product, which could have cumulative effects on the human body. The testing in animals showed, and actually the clinical testing of the one approved product showed that there were liver toxicity issues. You know, there are people who have liver problems. This could be very devastating for them. There are male reproductive potential damage to male reproductive system from using CBD products. Things that consumers really need to know about and could be bad for their overall health and well-being, that's some of the risk that's involved with these CBD products. So we're really saying it's a wild west out there. So that's where we come in as a consumer organization. You know, we're an honest broker here, and we're saying consumers, caveat emptor, let the buyer beware.
A lot of what contributes to the rise of these products in popularity is a lot of people are going to these as a way of treating things that otherwise could cost more with other prescription medications. Perhaps people don't have easy access to that kind of thing. So buyer beware. But overall, what would your one word of advice for consumers right now, or even right now retailers or organizations, to keep in mind going forward, knowing that it's going to be quite some time before more of these products are officially approved or disapproved by the FDA?
Yeah, you make a very good point. People may think, okay, well, I can't afford to see my healthcare provider right now, and I certainly am worried about what the cost of a prescription drug. So here's an easy way to treat this condition I have. It might be arthritis, it might be back pain, it might be migraines, and it says on the label it works for that. So I'm going to trust that. What I would say is, consumers, you can't trust that what's labeled on the product is actually going to result in therapeutic benefits for you. So for now, steer clear. We don't have any proof that these products that you are being sold have therapeutic benefits, and they could have some very negative healthcare consequences, not to mention that many of them in the testing that I mentioned are contaminated with arsenic and lead and toxic mold. None of us want to be swallowing a pill with any or putting anything in our body that have those kind of gross ingredients.
Definitely something to keep in mind given the rise in popularity of these products. But Sally Greenberg, thank you for taking the time today to talk with us about it.
You bet.
Sally Greenberg is the executive director of the National Consumers League. She joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski by phone in March. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for tuning in today. Please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.